Have you ever listened to the pod and thought it would be awesome if Jen stopped being nerdy about movies for 60 seconds and talked about your business instead? Well, my friends, you're in luck. Watch with Jen is looking for sponsors. Do you own or run a theater, bookstore, film fest, website, school, physical media firm, pod, streaming channel, or small business that might like to advertise on Watch with Jen? Whether you're interested in sponsoring one episode or several, please reach out. You can get a hold of me at contact@filmintuition.com. Thanks so much. Hey, this is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen. This week, I am delighted to be joined once again by my good friend, Kate Hagen, who is the Senior Vice President of The Blacklist, returning to the show for another conversation with some of our favorite independent filmmaking heroes. In the past, we've spoken to such greats as writer-director Allison Anders and actors-turned-producers Amy Robinson and Griffin Dunn. Today, we are honored to be chatting with the woman who received an award naming her a New York trailblazer, writer-director Nancy Savoca, who, along with her frequent co-writer, producer, and husband Richard Gay, who is also here, have made such groundbreaking and beloved award-winning and critically acclaimed indies as True Love, Dogfight, Household Saints, 24-Hour Woman, and more. Nancy and Rich, thank you so much for being here today. How are you doing? How's this year been treating you?
Amazing. But first of all, I just want to say I'm so happy to be here and on your show, joining the list of all these wonderful filmmakers that you speak about or speak to. And we really appreciate being here.
Oh, the pleasure is ours for sure. Yeah. And we were talking off air about your love of movies and acting kind of starting early. So I would be curious to know what made you first interested in filmmaking, pursuing that degree at NYU? Were you always a movie lover maybe since childhood? Or did you see something that suddenly made you think this is what you wanted to do? And Rich, same with you. What got you into movies as well?
For me, the answer is yes, 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 and yes. early on, I don't remember a time when there weren't movies around. My family immigrated to the U.S., so movies was a way to understand culture and language. And my sisters were teenagers when I was born, so the way they could kind of quiet me down when they had to take me along with them anywhere was to take me to the movies and just, like, you know, sit me down in the dark and give me popcorn. So definitely from, I don't remember when, I think maybe A Hard Day's Night might have been my first movie. Okay. Not sure, but it was pretty wild and crazy and girls were screaming in the theater. So that kind of certainly was always exciting for me.
Yeah.
And then throughout, we used to play making movies, me and my brother, you know, we never got bored. We would just make up stuff, play sets, you know, watch a film and then recreate it the minute the TV went off. We'd be off like recreating a scene or something. So, yeah.
That's so great.
Yeah, for me, I do remember my first movie that I saw in a theater was The Sound of Music.
Oh, wow.
That's pretty
very young. I guess I was 5 or something. Yeah. But I didn't really, I mean, I watched movies, I went to movies. I didn't really think about movies and how they were made or doing them until I met Nancy, who on the first time we ever met told me she wanted to be a director. And I was like, wow, that's cool. That's pretty cool. How do you do that? And you know, that started the
journey.
Yeah, 45 years ago, that question started that.
Yeah, we were 18, 19. Yeah.
So you guys were both students at NYU at the time?
No, actually, he worked at the deli around the corner from our house in the neighborhood, and my sister matched us up. And when we did meet that night, she told him to, like, deliver sausage. I'm not kidding. This is not a scene from Household Saints. delivered sausage, and I was working at Macy's. So when I came home from Macy's, he was delivering sausage right on time. And then my sister quietly took off and eavesdropped on the entire conversation between us. And
wow.
We stayed till 2 a.m. and she stood up listening. And the first thing she said when she saw me in the hallway was, "Why did you tell him you want to make movies? You want to scare the guy off?" So that was, yeah, that was the beginning. That was the first time we talked about it.
Oh my God, that is a household saint scene. And it totally makes sense, the prevalence of butcher shops and delis in your work. A huge piece just clicked into place in my brain.
Yeah, I love it so much too, the deli idea. I'm part Italian on my mom's side, and they actually did own, like, there was a butcher shop in the family. So watching these movies, it's like watching your relatives.
No, the food is so important for immigrant communities. It's how they stay themselves, like they're in a new country and they're able to taste the flavors that they had from childhood or grandparents or whatever. So really important. Yeah. And my dad was a cook, so that adds to everything.
Yeah. We're going to talk about food later in the episode.
Oh, good. My favorite topic after movies, with movies. I don't know. Before movies or after movies, anytime.
Why not both? I'm sort of wondering, you know, you guys have met, maybe NYU Film School is on the table. How do you go from the idea of I want to be a director to your first couple of short films, Renata and Bad Timing?
Well, I mean, I want to be a director is a huge step, first of all, for anybody. I think I don't know that there's ever a moment where an entire tribe will celebrate someone saying that, because it is a really interesting statement to make. And I think I said it at 17 to my parents, and that was kind of scary for them.
Yeah.
And basically it was like very, you know, like, don't, no, you shouldn't do this. This is like dangerous. Mm-hmm. And so I actually left home to go to film school. Mm-hmm. I didn't leave home to go to film school. Like, people graduate and go to college. No, I left home so that I could attend film school, because it was too scary for my parents. And the only way I could show that it was going to be okay was for me to just do it and then come back, and everything got settled. Happy ending. Everything was really fine. And actually my dad, who had the hardest time with it, was the one I grew closest to in his later years. And he traveled with us to film festivals and on location and sat next to me while I directed. And so it was quite lovely, but it's really scary. And from there, saying I want to be a director, going to film school was Rich's encouragement. I was at Queens College, and it was kind of a big, at that time, a very big, highly populated public school, and I couldn't get into a film class. I kept getting shut out of them. So I always tell film students, because I teach sometimes today, and I always tell them, pay attention to those classes you take when you're shut out of your favorite class, because that might be the things you're also interested in. And if you're looking to make movies or write or whatever, these, again, look for the themes that are going to follow you through your life. And sure enough, like, I took theater, I took acting, I took psychology, I took anthropology, sociology, like all those things really interested me. And you realize, oh, that goes into a movie.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite things about college, are, you know, the little accidents. You take these classes and you realize, oh, what I'm learning in history civilization also deals with something from sociology class, and you tie it all together. And I think one of the things I love the most about your films is I see it, and I see my relatives, the love, the fights, all of the stories passing down from generation to generation. But they're so universal, because that's everybody's family and the stories that get passed down. And I think it's a tribute to you and Rich as storytellers, and showing us how things change and also stay the same and get passed down, and worries. Not only you're not just passing down quilts, you're passing down all these neuroses and things. So I was wondering if you guys could speak to that, and maybe drawing on your background for these films.
Yeah, I think the first thing I want to say is the first time we encountered resistance to being very specific about the people we talk about was with True Love, because we did True Love. It was a personal story. It wasn't based. It was sort of loosely based on people we knew, but then we sort of knew enough, you know, if we were going to stay friends with everybody, that we wouldn't actually be exactly about these people. But I think that the when we sent out that script, and obviously we didn't have movie stars attached or anything like that, everybody later became, you know, known. But when we would send it out for funding, you know, as Rich as a producer, it was like, and Shelley Weiss, our co-producer, it was like the rejections always came back with a lot of was like, this is too specific. It's not universal. It's not
universal. Yeah.
Oh, yes. Wow.
It, you know, it's too ethnic, whatever words were appropriate, you know, it's too ethnic. It's too provincial. It's too local. It's too specific. It's all those things.
And today you'll hear it in other ways. You know, when people will turn down project, it's, you know, it's too, well, it's too Afrocentric, you know, because white people won't get it. It's too, you know, men won't get a woman's story, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's just not true. Let's just say it now. That is just not true. Mm-hmm. Story will grab you. And I, you know, relate to Al Pacino in Dog Day Afternoon. I have never held up. I did never had a partner who wanted a sex change. I never, you know what I mean? Like lay out all the situations. I totally get him. Yep. I totally get him. So anything, you know, fill in the blank of any movie that you adore, you get it because something connects with us. And that to me, I learned that with House, with True Love, because after we got rejected on the script a lot and we finally got it made, we were in Montreal for the film festival, and a young man in the audience stood up and he said, he was the young man who said, oh, through a translator, he said, I would like to take this movie home to my country, which is China, because there all the wedding preparations look just like this. Yeah. And that was like the first articulation of that. Yes. I knew it was true. I knew it would be universal. Yeah. To really have other people confirming it is really great.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I think it really speaks to the strength of something I was really struck by rewatching your films recently in terms of the production design and the costuming, specifically like the bridesmaids' dresses in True Love. I'm wondering, you know, particularly with True Love, you guys are working with a very small budget. You're working outside the studio system. How did you make sure those really authentic, really lived in details still made it into the film, even though you're working within this budget? And Rich, I'm curious too, you as a producer, how did you sort of deliver for Nancy as a producer when you're working with some limited resources?
Well, we were outside the studio system, but we were inside the neighborhood system.
I love that.
Those, you know, we had some very deep roots in that Morris Park community in the Bronx, and True Love specifically, the wedding gown and the bridesmaids dresses were all promoted from a local bridal shop. It's the same thing with the tuxedos. Most of the wardrobe in the movie was promoted from a store that is no longer in existence, but it's called Hot Stuff. Only one app.
We used to think you had to pronounce it Hot Stoof, but
yeah, that store let us go in there, let the costume designer go in, grab stuff off the rack, use it in the movie. Yeah. They brought it back, put it back on the rack.
Yeah, I know. Buy and return. We took it to new heights.
So yeah, the neighborhood played a big part in that.
And also, which we just remembered recently, is that wasn't Married to the Mob? Right before. So the wedding.
Yeah, that was 88. Yep.
Yeah, our mentors, one of our main mentors, and it are two big thank yous at the end of True Love. One is John Sayles. John Sayles, who got us started, and Kenny Utt, UTT, who got us finished. And Kenny is a producer with incredible credits. He's an amazing producer who did movies like French Connection and All That Jazz and stuff like that. And
if you actually ever want to do a show just on Kenny Utt, Rich made a movie with Jonathan Demme, a documentary on him that you could watch and just go take off. An amazing guy.
And Kenny, Jonathan's producer, did Silence of the Lambs and Philadelphia and Married to the Mob. But we were coming off of working on Married to the Mob, and Kenny actually you know, we got a lot of wardrobe from that show for free. Instead of it going to Goodwill, it came to us.
As well as the short ends of the film.
Yeah, 5mm short ends. Don't tell anyone at our, well, Orion, they exist as part of something else now. But, you know, we got a lot of short ends from 35. And the set, the one set that we built was the bathroom set at the end. And that set came from Married to the Mob. Throwaways. Wow. They've thrown it away. They threw it to us. So
if you ever anybody wants to do a double feature and just see what shows up.
Yeah. Married to the Mob and True Love.
The women's clothing and men's suits for the wedding party. Yeah. Definitely. I remember those racks coming in and just, you know, calling Jonathan and Kenny and saying, thank you. Thank you. You've that's dressed funny. Our people.
Oh, that's wonderful. True Love, I actually had not seen since film school. Nancy, I took a women in film class and we drew a name out of the hat and I got Nancy Savoca.
Oh,
so I did a project on your movie in college. This would have been like right early aughts, basically. And so that's when I saw True Love for the first time. And it was hitting right at the time I was seeing a lot of my friends getting married and maybe getting married for the wrong reasons. You know, the phrase starter marriages, unfortunately, but a lot of them are much happier now. They've figured out what they wanted to do and be. And so it was really tapping into a lot of the anxieties that my friends were having and I was having. And I feel like it's still timeless and watching it now in my 40s and thinking about that era, and it still feels just incredibly timeless. And so I was wondering, you know, you guys met and it was love immediately, but you were seeing things in the neighborhood and drawing on it. So talk to me about, you said you weren't going to base it 100% on people because you didn't want to, but talk to me about that time in your life. Yeah.
I mean, we met youngish. We didn't go to high school together, but we just lived around the corner from each other, but didn't know. That's New York. You can actually live around the corner from each other, not know each other, as opposed to in a smaller town. But I think for me, it was more like there was no question on most everything that we were expected to be doing.
Yeah.
And I was kind of pushing back on a lot of that, but a lot of my friends were not. So and I was very close to them. So it was, there was confusion and everyone sort of trying to figure it out. Cause it's weird. Cause here we are growing up in New York City, but just outside of the boroughs, like obviously this is like 1980, you know? So, you know, the women's movement had happened, you know, people were talking about it, but it took a while to hit
the boroughs
and a longer while to hit Latin communities and Italian communities, which I am both of.
Yeah.
To this day, I think we could have conversations about it hasn't exactly hit some places.
Sure. No.
It's really, for me, it was like trying to document and because we were so close to it, like documented like Margaret Mead so that I was like watching it, but watching it too, you know. That's where the anthropology comes in.
Right.
Exactly. These other classes, like you were saying.
Classes were super helpful.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think you start to feel too that appreciation, not just for we're making a movie, but we're exploring a people, we're exploring a culture. There's such a sense of tactility in all your films, be it the food, be it the body language, be it these rituals we're sort of having a courtside seat for. And I'm wondering how you translate all those very sort of ephemeral feelings from your brain to the page, to the set, to the actors, to final cut. And Rich, in tandem, how do you sort of, you know, whether it's talking to financiers, talking to other producers, how do you get them to trust Nancy's vision is this, and it needs to be this way because we are indeed being authentic to a particular culture?
Ooh, I'll let you go first. Because that was
that's harder and harder every day well, everyone always thinks they know better and also, you know, and everyone is it's interesting the way you frame the question, because everyone thinks they're making a product. And what do you do when you make a product? I mean, we want to build a car or a washing machine that everybody wants to use. We don't want to build a washing machine for the Italian community or Italian Americans. We have to build it for everyone. So there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of pressure on that. And the times when we've been able to do it, you know, I have to say, Nancy has pretty much gotten final cut in most of her films. Of course, True Love, there was, you know, we financed that with equity money, a limited partnership, so there was no question that she would have control. But then it started to be different with other.
But even with True Love, once it was going to be sold, most of the companies we spoke to wanted to change the ending. So
right to change the ending before going in. All of them. I have to say the independents were worse. The reason the film wound up with MGM is because they agreed to leave the final cut to Nancy. Mm-hmm. And this was a film that was eye-opening to me, because, you know, we had raised that money. We had worked for free. Everybody had basically, the actors had all worked for free. We had spent 6 years trying to put it together. And we got it together. We go to Sundance. We win Sundance. And all that the film distribution companies wanted was the ability to change it. And it was like, wow.
And it's kind of so amazing, because we really were so green. And we thought, first of all, we were so shocked that we won Sundance, and B, that Sundance was a big deal, because it wasn't literally when we submitted the film, it wasn't, and then it was. It was that we were at the Sundance that kind of exploded with Michael Moore and Soderbergh. That was like the year that all happened. So when that happened, we were like, wow, this is amazing. This puts us in a really great situation. And to have people say, and I have to say, Richard Price has a great quote, which I'm not going to remember all of it, about screenwriting, which to me is very similar to filmmaking, like screenwriting. I love it means change it. So everybody, love it, change it. So so surprised, because change it to what? And the what was going to be, which haunts me all the time, the happy ending. All the time. Yeah. Because I think people see hope in. I'm not a Debbie Downer with the stories, but I think we do talk about challenges and people that are really fighting and struggling. Mm-hmm. But at the end, there's like, I think everybody can kind of feel that they could make a happy ending. And they want it. And meaning the distributors or the studios have wanted it. And it just changes the whole movie. I mean, we can talk more when we talk about Dogfight, but yeah.
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 But, so that presentation of trying to get companies to trust the vision, it's not that easy, you know. And it has only gotten a little worse as algorithms start controlling things.
Big old thumbs down. Yeah.
Yes.
It's exactly. Like saying, you know, I love chocolate ice cream today. Like, do I need to have it tomorrow again? Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. Like, what if I want something else?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But what if we put some Oreos in the chocolate ice cream and put a new label on it, and then
like, you know, making it every day? Yeah. So yeah. So it is. It's been tough. As for the other question with, I forget what word you used for it, like the
tactility, like everything is so well felt in your films. I was thinking about it a lot, seeing Household Saints again in a theater. There's just such a texture to everything, the tablecloths, the food, the wallpaper, the freezer door that opens, that I don't know, I feel like that's missing in so many modern movies.
Well, I think part of that is I'm always going to pat myself on the back for recognizing talent in people. So I work with incredibly talented people and crew, and For True Love, it was, and Dogfight, it was Lester Cohen, and True Love, you know, my cinematographer was Lisa Rinsler, and then Bobby Bukowski for Dogfight, and then for Household Saints was Bobby Bukowski again, a DP, and Kalina Ivanov as production designer. those folks and the wardrobe costume person, Eugenie Buffalucas, who did a couple of them for me, those folks, I think that we begin by speaking a lot and then allowing them to, you know, take the information they got from me. And I always say it's got to start with the information I got. Otherwise, you know, everyone can read the same script and come up with a different.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Put everybody on the same page. But once everyone's on the same page, just let her rip and just go out and what do you find and come back with your thoughts and ideas and stuff. And it's always better than what I can imagine. So because everyone I think is really invested in it, that you're looking at all those, every part of the filmmaking, just, you know, everyone coming in with like this passion and excitement and bringing us the best, really. So for me, it's like kid in the candy shop. Like, what do I get to choose from? You know.
Yeah. I mean, sure. From observing Nancy, she really works off. I think she works a lot, mostly off emotion, and she works with every department. Like, you know, in Household Saints, how do you convey things from Francine's fabulous book? How do you turn that into something, an emotion that gets evoked on screen. Mm-hmm. And that's everybody. I mean, you know, that's Kalina, it's the photography, it's the design, it's the actors,
the music,
the actors, of course, mm-hmm. Front and center. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think there's an approach to everything, which is about evoking those feelings and about understanding what the themes that she's talking about, and then it's the puzzle of figuring out how to evoke them.
I love that. In collaboration, you start to bring out the best and ask questions you might not have known you were going to ask. I remember when we talked to Allison Anders, she told a great story about making Gas Food Lodging and how the production designer started asking a question about, okay, did they live here with the husband who left? And what was that marriage like? And like the production designer came up with an idea of there would be a dent in the wall where eggs had been thrown with breakfast and a, you know, wow. Something she never would have thought about because of a question that was asked. And so I think it's, you know, you surround yourself with great people, believe in great people, and you're going to bring out the best in each other. And I see that with your films because they're labors of love. I love all of the people that are involved, especially in talking about true love. I know you guys had to cast that outside of SAG. Was that correct? So how was that process and discovering that talent?
Wow. Well, that took a long, long time. And Annabella, we discovered early on when we did we actually, as we struggled to find the money, we decided to pool all our resources and just do a little, I think
shoot
today,
something. We call it,
today to be proof of concept, but it was like a short film. We just did a little, like almost a trailer of a teaser of some of the scenes of the movie. And through that, we put out an ad in Backstage. We knew we weren't working with SAG. We couldn't afford SAG. And we just went and one of the first people show that who was perfect was Annabella. And that's how we met Annabella through SAG. We used to joke in those days that most of our friends were through Backstage ads. Like we just made. But so Annabella was first. And then she brought a lot of the cast along, I have to say, again, from New York theater.
Yeah.
And then
and
Ricky Shapiro. Yeah. And then we had two casting directors because that's how long it took us to get the money over the year. We literally had a couple of years of that. So we burned through two casting directors who were both wonderful and super passionate and worked for nothing. And they brought us cast. And Todd Thaler and Brianna Benjamin. So then by the time we were getting ready to shoot, we had the money, but we didn't have a Michael. So we had a Donna forever. And we saw every actor who was not in SAG, every Italian-American actor. And to this day, I still meet wonderful people that I'm like, oh, you know, I auditioned for you for True Love.
Yeah.
Sorry, it didn't work out. But then, Ron Eldard came in 2 weeks before we started shooting.
Wow.
Yeah. It was like,
it was a long process. That's like, that covers about 2.5-3 years.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
We had nothing else to do. So every few months we'd write, we'd rewrite the script and then we'd say, let's do a casting session. And
the way, actually, you should say how our funding came in, because that's an interesting story as well. We couldn't fund the movie because, again, we didn't have any name actors and we weren't going to get any name actors. So,
We had worked. The first real movie we worked on was The Brother from Another Planet, John Sayles.
John Sayles, yep.
Nancy actually took that job, working as a
production
free intern in the office. Eventually, I guess it was assistant coordinator.
I got bumped up.
Promoted. But I would just hang around because I was working as in accounting at the time. I was a CPA outside the industry. And I was just hanging around I'd hang around after work. We just became friendly. I mean, it was Peggy Reisky was one of the producers and Maggie Renzi. Mary Cebulski, who was the production coordinator, Nancy's boss, who would become a script supervisor.
For True Love, she became
Love, right. Dogfight. And anyway, we met, and her husband was John Tintori, who became our editor. But basically, we just became friendly with Maggie and John, and they would, every once in a while, I'd come, have dinner together and be like, well, what's happening? And we tell them the latest struggles, the latest things that we were doing.
It was mostly trying to get House True Love made. That's all we did.
We didn't have any plan B. And at one point, as I tried, and I believe that some company had optioned it, we did a rewrite for them, and it never went anywhere. And John would just, sort of watching us, flail away. One night he said, well, if you made it for really, really low budget, I would invest.
Oh, wow.
And I was like,
yeah,
really? How low and how much?
Yeah, the accountant questions.
Yeah. So, I went in and did the most illogical thing, which was I said, okay, cut the above the line completely, so nobody above the line gets paid, because they tend to be the ones who get rewarded when something is successful. So yeah. We would not get paid. Our co-producer would not get paid. Our
cast
would not get paid. And so we made, and sort of at that point, and then John came in and we started, I was also at the time I was working on Something Wild. Nancy and I were working on that movie, and Kenny Utt was a producer and went to him, and he came in for some cash, and then he went to Jonathan Demme and said, you guys should invest too. And basically John was like, okay, and Jonathan came on board.
Wow.
Seidelman came on board because Shelley Weiss had worked with Susan Seidelman.
Oh, wow.
So we knew that our celebrity investors, and even though they could not fund the entire movie, just the fact that they invested something was like a good housekeeping seal of approval.
It kind of allowed me to go to some doctors and dentists and get some
money. Yeah.
And it also gave me a lot of credibility. See, that's the thing I tell my students is being around, working at McDonald's and wanting to make a movie is very different from working as a PA and wanting to meeting people. And so the kinds of people I was meeting in accounting were, I was working with the labs and with the sound houses and the post-production facilities and all that. So the rental houses. So I was able to go in and make deals. The incredible Irwin Young, who ran Duart, the patron saint of many independent New York
absolutely
filmmakers, where I was able to make a deal with him for the processing and to defer a lot. So it kind of came together. Again, it was a very long process, and with each of those things in the budget being pieced together over time, including our own whatever we could scrape together,
right? And in the middle of that, we had our first baby.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, Peel, in addition to that, just becoming parents. Yeah, yeah. Just real quick.
I know how you planned your life, so I'm going to do all these things first, and then,
Yeah.
Time is great. Yeah, no, That didn't happen. So my son was born. And then 2 weeks before we started shooting, I found out I was pregnant again. And when we went Sundance, I wasn't there because I was having a baby. So I was, so the personal life also never, ever, ever, ever wanted to be separated from my work life. I tried, but it did not happen. So after that, I sort of figured, oh, okay, this is the way it's going to work for me. It may not be for everybody else, but this is the way it's going to work for me. And that actually became definitely something then for the rest of my, you know, time to this day continues.
Mm-hmm. And then becomes, you know, the subject of something like the 24-hour woman, too, in terms of how do you do this juggle? I want to take a step back before we get there, though. And I'm wondering about the sort of transition moment from True Love Wins Sundance. You guys are sort of celebrated as up and coming filmmakers. How does Dogfight then come into the picture, particularly in terms of bringing in Lily Taylor and River Phoenix, who are very much both on the ascent as well at that point?
Yes. So we got the script for Dogfight very soon after Sundance. Peter Newman, who was one of the producers, sent us the screenplay, but as mentioned just now, I had just had my second baby, and I was not ready to go on a shoot again. So we said, thank you so much for thinking of us. We need to pass right now. And I think, Richard, you were the one who sort of put it really well. Like, if anything, you know, if in the future, like next year, you're still, you know, I don't remember how you said
it. I mean, it was just, basically it was a pass, not now.
Please, you know, please come back, you know.
Because
the story was really, really interesting.
And so we went through the process with MGM, and we, you know, we had to go out and actually finish the film to sell it to them, because we had to go and license all the music.
For
True Love, I'm sorry. So we did all of that, but now it's the summer, and we don't really have the next thing, and True Love is going to come out. So I just picked up the phone and I called Peter. I didn't tell her. I called Peter and I said, hey, what's going on with that thing? And he said, wow, your timing's incredible.
Wow.
It just dropped out. Are you interested in re-engaging? And that's when, I went back to Nancy and I said, well, you know, this thing is available. Do you want to give it a shot? And the movie was actually, Peter had it set up already at Warner Brothers.
And actually before we went out, it was already cast with River Phoenix.
Yes.
Wow.
So I needed, before anything, to have a conversation with River. And at that time it was a phone call. He was living in Gainesville in Florida. And we just spoke on the phone, and I'll never forget that call, because it started off as like a, you know, like a sort of a business call, whatever, and very polite. And then we just ended up on the phone for a very long time, several hours. And by the end, you know, it was like really great. He just was such a smart, he was 19. Hmm. He was, and I was like 28. So it's like, I was like his big sister. So it was like, it was such a smart, fun phone call that I knew that it would be great to work with him. And I said, listen, I just want to let you know, I think this project is really interesting. The part that's really challenging is what I'm very attracted to. So, you know, I just want to let you know that before I get off the phone, because he was going to really give the okay for it. And even before he hung up, he says, I want to work with you. And he says, I really enjoyed this talk. You remind me of my mother, and she's from the Bronx too.
That was
really, really fun part, his mom. So yeah, so that started. Then now the next step was to go to LA and have the meeting.
And again, it was a lot of really good fortune, because as luck would have it, and probably the only way we would have traveled out there was if somebody was paying, was that True Love was opening in LA. And Nancy had her meeting at noon on that Friday. And I remember, I will never forget the opening line. It's like the LA Times review, the opening line was, True Love marks the debut of a major new independent American filmmaker. And I was like,
oh.
I looked at that. I wasn't in the meeting. It was Nancy and Peter. And I said, she's got it. I mean, yeah. Come on, you know. So, and it, with all of that, with Rivers signing on, and with this thing, with this in front of them, and they had her in the office, and it was a natural. It just came together. So that was pretty much very interesting
because I remember that meeting. I remember that they had Xeroxed the review and put it in front of everybody. But I remember that meeting because they were like asking me questions like, you know, who are your favorite filmmakers and stuff? And I was saying like Altman and Cassavetes and Melvin Van Peebles.
They should have known.
And kind of like they just wanted to say yes. So it's so interesting to be in the room when someone is ready to say yes, like, and you're in the seat opposite them. So it was kind of great, but they should have really listened to what I was saying because they were making surprise. But yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's actually my personal favorite of your films for sure. I'm related to a number of Marines. So I remember in college, when I was doing my Nancy Savoca project, I kind of zeroed in on Dogfight and what it said about coming of age for young men in a hyper-masculine situation setting. I found it really fascinating, and I love the way that River Phoenix, his character, as he gets to know this intelligent, passionate, sort of sensitive young woman, we see a different side of him as the night goes on and he gets further away from the group think and the influence of these guys. And I can imagine it must have been, especially because it wasn't your screenplay, but must have been hard to find the right balance in tone, because you don't want to get you don't want to be accused of being too preachy, but you don't want to go the other way and make it too hard-edged. So you know, you're walking down kind of a tightrope, especially early on in that picture. So what was that like in trying to work with those cast members and strike the right balance?
It was really interesting because I think I, for whatever reason, I did not think of the things that would frighten me away from it. Although, you know, during the making of it, we were shooting in Seattle, and there was the Seattle Film Festival, and we went to it, and someone from the audience said, "I heard you're making this movie, and why would you do this?" Like, it was very, like, so I that was like it was like almost like someone threw cold water in my face, and I was like, "Oh, is this how people react to the subject matter?" Oh, duh. So, but I think what got me was that I really loved the era. I loved the year. I was very curious at poking around at this mythology of America being like innocent and then not. And because I kind of like it never felt right to me. It's like we've had assassinations of presidents before Kennedy. And, you know, we've certainly had a lot of dark history that we've never been very innocent at all. Our nation is quite not innocent. But anyway, so I kind of knew all these things. And I was curious to sort of see what was in there and basically like the roles we play as a country, the roles we play as men, the roles we play as women. One of the most exciting things for me as a filmmaker is that I get to embody everybody, that I get to be all the characters. So again, I could have probably been afraid of it, but like looking back on it, but honestly, I wanted the opening of the film to really feel like we're with the guys.
Yeah.
So if we're going to have fun, we're going to have fun. And then the minute they stop having fun, we're going to stop having fun. And the universality of that is, no, I have never taken a girl on an ugly date contest. However, cruelty is something we have all experienced being the victim of, the perpetrator of. And that really interested me. That really interested me to look at it from both sides of that. And again, the privilege of being a director is that you get to jump around and see points of view from different places.
Mm-hmm. I've seen Dogfight 3 or 4 times before, but for some reason yesterday I was like, oh my God, how did they clear the Dylan sample for this? How did you guys get a Dylan song in the movie? And I was thinking about it too during Household Saints, because that was the week Melanie passed away. And then to hear Candles in the Rain in a movie theater was like, whoa, that was very surreal. But music is such a huge part of all of your films, you know, sort of all those great oldies and True Love as well. And I'm just wondering how you guys sort of mesh that with the fabric of the movie you're making and how you clear a Bob Dylan song. That feels like a magic trick unto itself.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
Van Morrison.
That was like, oh, and Van Morrison. Well, we're fans, right? So yeah. I remember like the night, right? Because we could only shoot, what is that? 6 hours of night in Seattle, because we shot this movie in the summertime in Seattle, and it's an all night long movie. Yikes, kind of a mistake, because you're like, I don't have enough nightlight. Forget about, you know, you always fight day. We fought having nightlight. And I remember the night that we were shooting in the bedroom where she puts the record on, the Freewheelin' album that has the song, and Don't Think Twice. And I remember Rich downstairs, we had to go up. Well, we had to go inside. It was a set. It's so weird. I'm thinking it's real. And we went upstairs. But it was like, before going on the set, he's like, you got to like shoot a couple of choices on that Dylan, because we're not going to be able. And silly, because it doesn't matter. I, you know, even if I hadn't shot choices, if we wouldn't have done the song, I would have had to do an insert somewhere.
Yeah.
Something well, like, I have to say, no, we're only shooting the Dylan album.
Dylan album, but every piece of furniture in that frame was saved, because I said, we have to hold on to this stuff.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And I don't exactly remember the set dressing in the frame, but I just said, save all that, because we're never going to. Yeah, that's what, you know, when you have some, that's what they call temp lock, right? When the director hears something, and now there is no other song in the entire universe that could ever replace that. And we all became immersed in that temp lock. Actually, there are several songs in the movie that have that feeling. But that one especially,
Shake Sugary, has that feeling Shake for Sugary, me. The Van Morrison.
Yeah, Shake Sugary was in the script.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah. That Bob Comfort had written. And yeah, I mean, the long and the short of it is, it took a long time. We started that process very early while we were shooting, because the initial reaction to getting a quote for that, now this was back then, was, and of course there were two sides to it when you're licensing music, there's the master and there's the publishing. The initial quote was starting at six figures for each side. And there was no way we could go there. I mean, this is like 30 years ago or more. And so it was a group effort. The head of music at Warner Brothers worked on this. Our music supervisor, Jeff Kimball,
fantastic guy
who went on to a terrific career. He's no longer he's now producing documentaries and making documentaries. But somehow or another, he found somebody who found somebody who found somebody who knew one of Bob's old assistants. And when we got into post-production, literally flew that person to a concert to where Bob was playing. And my understanding, because I wasn't in the room, my understanding was that they had a tape and they played him a clip of the film. And that's how we got it at a significant discount. Still a lot of money, still the most expensive, I think it's still the single most expensive piece of music I've ever had to license. But yeah, it was it was a long, long effort. But I'm with her. I can't see any other song in that slot. There's no other, you know, nothing else would have worked. So yeah, that one alone was one thing. But we just had a very creative Jeff Kimball was a music supervisor on all three of those first films. And we just had a very, you know, he was very creative, and that he and Nancy worked again. You know, I tell my students, you know, think about music in pre-production. Like, yeah. what is it? You know, yeah. what do you want? What do you need? Think about it. And I remember there being not full on cue sheets with all the publishing and all the rights there, but every scene and the description of the music in the scene and what they thought it was going to be. Before we started shooting, everything was really, you know, was really considered and thought through.
And of course, in the, you know, post in the editing room, you make sure. But boy, that Dylan song was definitely in the works for a long time. And when we played it, and when our editor, you know, played it against the cut scene, it was like, then perfect. I got very nervous. And then I was like, oh no, this is really bad. If this doesn't work, I don't know what's going to happen. Yeah.
It's funny. I've heard John Sayles tell a similar story about the Springsteen songs in Baby It's You, that it was very similar in terms of like, well, we reached out to people and somebody knew somebody who was able to show Bruce the movie, and Bruce liked the movie, so he gave us the music. But yeah, I think, and Jen, not to take up too much air, but I think that's an interesting way of transitioning to talking a bit about missing movies and these kind of music rights, literary rights, all these things that are keeping all these incredible 80s and 90s indies particularly out of circulation and out of mainstream. And I'm going to shut up because you guys, I got to hear you tell the sort of missing movies story as it related to Household Saints when I saw it here in Los Angeles. But if you could tell us a little bit more about sort of bringing that film back to audiences and how the missing movies of it all led there.
I have a quick talking about the music really quickly, though. I did want to pass along a compliment because when I was watching Dogfight this time, somebody, I always post like what I'm watching kind of to, so people know what's coming on the pod. And I mentioned this and somebody said, you know, as much as I love T.B. Sheets in Martin Scorsese's Bringing Out the Dead, it's better in this. So I just had to let you know, like, they're like, I can't watch that movie without, like, it's perfect here. So I just wanted to let you know, you guys, you know, kudos to you both and the music supervisor. Yes.
Exactly. Exactly. And Van, you can't go wrong with Van.
I know.
Really? That's not, oh my God. And I love Van. I'm a huge fan.
Oh, you didn't see it? God. You didn't see it?
What?
That song, you didn't imagine?
No.
Oh, okay.
Wow. No, I didn't imagine. Really, that song? Yeah. Oh my God.
No, because I think I brought that to Jeff.
Know, I think that was, I don't know how you, how, where it came
from. Oh no, because
I saw it in the cut.
It was a perfect coming home.
Yeah. It has sort of a Vietnam or an otherworldly feel. Yes. And then, and shows time going by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And those boys, just like you had people in your family, like I had people in my neighborhood, the boys came back. When the boys came back, they weren't the same boys that left.
Yeah.
So, Definitely.
Yeah. So missing movies.
Okay.
Missing movies.
I, you know, the beginnings of this were Household Saints was the beginning of it in the sense that we went through a period where we thought all of the materials had been destroyed for the film, and all that was left was a VHS cassette, literally.
And as many people know, if you follow the movie, is that it never got the DVD release. So where it ended, stopped right there.
Right. And so we thought we had 35 millimeter prints at the UCLA Film Archive until Ira Deutschman, who actually was the distributor on the film, who greenlit the film when he was running Fine Line, until he wanted to show a print. And we were told that there were too much damage. Several reels on each of the prints were damaged. And so basically, no, you don't have a 35 print.
Wow.
And that led us on a journey over a couple of years that we did locate all the materials. The rights had expired. We had to go back and buy. We were able, very fortunate that, again, following the trail of John Sayles and Maggie Renzi, we were able to negotiate to get the rights back from the rights holder. But in this process, then there was probably, it started in 2018. So it's 6 years ago. In all this journey, Nancy does what she usually does and says, wow, you know, if I'm going through this, there must be a lot of people going through this.
Mm-hmm.
And so she said, she decided to go to Mary Harron, who runs the
Independent Directors Committee of the DGA.
The DGA, on the East Coast. And say, you know, talk to her about it and say, maybe we should do something about this, on this subject. And Mary, it turns out, was going through it, the same process or a similar process with I Shot Andy Warhol. Now that film was amazing,
What's interesting is also, like, you know, it's a very interesting thing to try and define missing movies. And some people actually have like stopped short of organizing around this concept because it doesn't have one definition. Because as you mentioned, Kate, there's you can have a missing movie because the music rights have lapsed, mm-hmm. so you can't show it anymore, or your contract with whoever, if it was a novelist or whatever, some kind of rights issue. But it could also be, you know, in our cases, we didn't know who was the owner of the film at one point, because the company had sold it. And then it went to somebody, and we had to figure out who the somebody was. And then he was dead, and then we had to figure out with the estate.
As Maggie says, because she's in the process of going through this with all 17 of John's movies, they're either lost, stolen, or strayed.
Wow.
You know, so there's no one story, which is what is both fascinating and challenging, is, you know, is it the rights? Is it the elements missing? And this stuff goes missing all the time. I mean, you know, Stop Making Sense was just re-released, and that was actually restored from a 35 millimeter IP that they, thank God, found in Jonathan's archives at the University of Michigan. Now, why did he have a 35 millimeter IP? I have no idea, but he did. And if he hadn't, the film would not have been restored.
Wow.
Out of this concept, they did a webinar at the DGA. They pulled in Mira Nair, and Mira had just gone through this process with
Mississippi Masala, right?
Yeah. So it was a really successful webinar. We did it in the fall of 2020. But the people on the panel included Ira and Sue Bodine, who's our entertainment lawyer, who's been our lawyer for all 45 of those years. Dennis Doros and Amy Heller from Milestone Films, who are distributing Household Saints, was on the panel. And Mary Harron, of course. And everybody saw sort of...
Ayoka Shinzira. Also, Alma's Rainbow was also restored and found.
So a group of us decided we should keep talking about this, because this was a much bigger issue than anyone had really ever identified. And we have been meeting by Zoom every 2 weeks since. And we formed a not-for-profit called Missing Movies, at missingmovies.org. And the mission is basically twofold. It's help filmmakers who are in this situation,
mm-hmm.
And raise awareness amongst filmmakers and general audience that, you know, there's a reason the films are missing. That's on one side. And then the other side is to try and prevent it from happening.
And in the
future filmmakers.
And in the education part of preventing it from happening, it's funny when you mention, and I'm hearing that a lot from people, like they're looking at these movies and going, there's layers, there's textures, there's stuff. And one of the things I think that helps a filmmaker get layers and textures and stuff is to allow themselves time, regardless of whatever the company that's giving you the money says, regardless of whatever time you have, you make your own and you figure out your own. And in that time, you go searching for nurturance, you go searching for movies that'll feed you. And you go searching for movies that came before you that will feed you. It doesn't mean you're copying. I have to like have this argument with students. You're not copying people. You're being influenced by people, and you're allowing yourself to be influenced by people. And one of the things that I find really disheartening today is that if I know a young filmmaker that's got a screenplay and they, you know, and I've like sort of like asked me for feedback, one of the things I'll always say is like, here's a list of movies that are related to your screenplay. This will get you excited. This will give you some stuff to work with. And mm-hmm. most of the times those movies are not available. Yeah. So that's becoming an issue for the next generation. They don't have the influence unless, you know, someone happens to decide that they're going to stream it for a few months and then pull it. Mm-hmm. So you catch that.
And I think that the big thing for me is that we've been sold on this idea that everything's available. And in fact, it's the exact opposite.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the greatest video, you know, I mean, there was an article very recently about if you're really a cinephile, you should you should subscribe to Amazon Prime because they have over 12,000 titles. It's like, you know, there were video stores in Manhattan that had 60,000 titles. The greatest video store of all time, Netflix, when they were doing
my old employer,
had 110,000 titles at one.
They were the biggest video store in the planet.
Yes, you know, this is cutting across a lot of places. Like there was a recent article about gamers. Now, video games are disappearing.
Yeah.
It's the advent of them being online and no more physical media. You're sold something, and it's just like when we buy. It's a joke. I mean, we're buying movies online, and it's there, and I can look at my Amazon account and see that it's there. It's not there forever. I don't really own it. It's kind of an extended rental because a license expires or something happens, and they decide, and it's gone.
Yeah,
you know. So it's we part of the early Missing Movies activity was research, and we went back and looked at Sundance from the beginning of the festival through I think 2006 or 2007, and looking at all the titles that had been selected. Now it's the major U.S. film festival that curates supposedly the best of American film, and there were over 1,400 titles that are nowhere to be found, including True Love, and grand prize winners, movie stars. It doesn't matter.
No,
you know.
No. And of course, you know, and then we can stop talking about this because you can see we could do like a show. You could just do a show on this.
We should.
We got to do the missing movie special, I think, is what I'm hearing from this conversation. Yeah.
Kind of a passion project. Yeah.
And I think one of the most important things for me, because I felt it coming like a train, like I'm on the train track and I felt that train coming. And I said to Rich at one point when Household Saints really kind of disappeared, I said, this is how we disappear from history.
Yeah.
This is how someone, you know, will never know that we did these films. This is how it happens. And it happens first, you know, canaries in the coal mine. It happens first to people of color, women of all colors. It happens to the people at the margins, LGBTQ, all the filmmakers that are not centered. It happens to us first. So that it's just really important because, again, then, you know, 50 years from now, 60 years from now, some kids studying film in school. And it's like, oh, you mean there were Black filmmakers? Like we had to say, we who went to the top film schools
did
not know our film history, do not know about our film ancestry. We don't know it, you know? So I think this is another reason why it's important for the next group. But that's
for any filmmaker listening. Go to missingmovies.org. On there is a tab that says Preservation Guide for Filmmakers. It's in its infancy right now, but basically when you finish your movie, whether it's a short film or a feature or whatever it is, you have everything you need to preserve it. You just need to organize the files and know what to do with them. And this preservation guide will give you a list of files and a lot of information.
And it was compiled with experts. So we have archivists and preservationists who gave us information, and that's how we got it in there.
Yeah. And we're building it out to a curriculum that we hope will.
Oh, I love that. We are going to have to do a follow-up episode on that because that is a passion project. Kate is someone who has researched video stores and the dwindling numbers, and she did an entire article on it, and she's in a documentary about it. I worked for DVD Netflix for years, and I would write articles. They were a sponsor of this podcast, and in the end, I was kind of trying to drum up support by talking about movies that weren't available here. And I remember shocking people because I did an article on John Woo, three of his most famous movies, not available, Hard Boiled, The Killer, and another one, Once a Thief, is not available here. And also, I think Bullet to the Head is not, like a bunch of them are not available on streaming, or they were once available on Criterion. And I think a lot of people just assume, oh, I have Netflix, I have everything, and they do not. So I am so glad that after all of these years of like a video copy being on YouTube that people would watch, I watched it on my show with my friend William Boyle. We did an episode on like underrated Italian American movies, and we talked about Household Saints. So I'm really glad Maura Lynch is someone who follows me on Twitter, and I mentioned Household Saints, and she sent me a message. She said, I sold those rights to Nancy Savoca.
Yes. Oh, wow.
Small world. Yes.
Nancy's agent. Oh,
yes.
My gosh.
Yes.
Wow.
So I'd love to hear more about this movie.
Wow. Yeah. I was in college when I read that book. I wrote her a love letter saying, I love your novel. I'm in film school now, but one day I'm going to make a movie. Like, I was just in love. That's great. That is awesome.
That's wonderful.
We can move on, but I do have to tell you guys, when I wrote the piece about video stores, I talked about a couple of my white whales, and one of them was Household Saints, yes, along with Beth B's Two Small Bodies and Alan Moyle's Times Square. And now they're all on Blu-ray, and I could honestly weep 5 years later. Yeah.
So great. So great. Oh, God, Times Square. I love Times Square.
Yeah.
No,
thank you, Kino Lorber. Thank you, Criterion. Yes. Thank you, all the boutique labels doing this work, making these more, titles.
We really want to encourage and let, I just keep thinking, let younger people see opportunity for, I don't know how this is going to work out. We didn't put this together to have the solutions. We came with this to, like, you know, sound the alarm, like this stuff is like disappearing. What are we, you know, what leverage, don't let it happen in the future, but what can we do about what the past is? And it's a lot of films. There's not one organization that's going to save them all. So it's everybody pulling their weight, everybody showing awareness. And maybe people seeing opportunity in finding these movies. A lot of these movies that are missing never even got distribution. So we don't even know what's out there. We don't even know what's out. So there's a lot of opportunity out there for people who love films to experience more of them. But anyway, well, this is great.
Kate, did you have a specific Household Saints question? Because I know you wanted to talk about that one too.
I don't know. It's such a fascinating film. I took a friend to see it who had never seen it. And I was like, you're going to love this. I already know you're going to love this. And it's such an interesting film tonally. And I think pulls off a lot of tonal magic tricks. There was a legitimate gasp in the audience. And this is a huge spoiler for the movie. So if you haven't seen it, now is a great time to stop listening. as we're following Lily Taylor's character in the final third of the movie. And then she ends up passing away and becoming a sort of everyday saint. It's so incredible always to hear an audience be legitimately shocked by something, especially in this sort of over-telegraphed, you know, sort of everything is spoon-fed to the audience world. It's so nice to hear people be legitimately surprised by something. And I'm wondering, in translating the novel, if a lot of that tone, the sort of shifts from the tragic to the comic and back, that was in the novel, or that was something that you all sort of brought to it in adapting it as well?
I think Francine has that in her. Like, you spend 5 minutes with Francine.
Conversation with Francine.
Yeah, it's a typical conversation with Francine as you left, right? And I think for me, you know, I think, yeah, I want to say it's cultural for me because it comes from my family. We laugh, cry a lot. You know, every some's a joke and it's like really, really funny. And then it just reminds you of something horrible and then you just start crying. So that, and I think it's just really, you know, different people. I don't know anymore. I can't claim it as being specifically from here or there. It's just some of us think funny things are sad and sad things are funny, you know?
Yeah.
And I can see that happen sometimes. Like I'll be laughing with a friend of mine over something. And then somebody's in the room and going like, that's actually really horrible what you're laughing at. No, it's just so painful. It's funny. You know, it's like and that. Sometimes that's also like a release. You know, we know that it's like the psychology of it all. That's where the psychologist comes in and goes like, yeah, you're just trying to handle this. You know? But yeah, so the story had it there. And then it was such a joy to work with that because it was complicated.
And again, that emotion is what Nancy does best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, emotion is such an integral part of these films and these stories. And I love also the way that they are female-centric and you work so well with these tremendous female casts, like 24 Hour Woman. My goodness, rewatching that movie, I hadn't seen that in a while too. And I mean, I'm a huge Rosie Perez fan, but then you have Marianne Jean-Baptiste, you have just this incredible cast. You're working with so many great women, and this goes throughout your entire career. Lily Taylor, of course, you worked with multiple times. So what is the casting process like? Are you very hands-on? I mean, we talked about True Love, of course, but then from then on?
Totally. I mean, I work with, again, you know, thank you to all the casting directors I work with, because they're all have been amazing. I mean, I got to work with Marion Doherty, the legendary Marion Doherty, and for Dogfight. And I learned so much, so much from sitting next to her for a couple of weeks. I think the thing is just kind of being open. Like, you kind of have an idea who you want, kind of, not in terms of name actors. I can't even think that way. I don't know how to think that way, but more like what's the essence of these characters that you're noticing? Mm-hmm. So you just kind of, it's on the radar, like, of anybody who walks into the room to see what they're doing and if that's picking up. But I realize, even if they're not doing it, if they're doing a reading or a monologue or whatever, and it's not what I was looking for, if I still have a really good feeling about it, I'll just start working with them and just see what else is here, you know, and never giving up until I've made sure that, you know, we've tried everything and, you know, let's see if they hear me and if I can hear them and if we can work together. And so it's kind of exhausting. It's a very tiring process in a way, but very, very exciting. And also, I want to say, you know, it's interesting because I think it's less common to see women in these kind of roles. That's why we notice the women and the actresses, the incredible actresses I worked with. But I think the guys in all these films.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Like, Wendell Pierce is right there. And like,
or River or Pirelli or Vincent D'Onofrio.
I love. Yes.
Oh my God. Victor Argo. You know, it's like those guys that just they come and they give, like, super generously. They're ready. They come in ready to play, which is an exciting thing for me. I think when you feel that the actors are coming in and they're not, you know, even if everybody's got their nerves, you know, everybody's going to be nervous for a while, but after like a little bit of time, the nerves go away and then you're just ready to play and see what's there. And that's the most exciting thing, I think.
And you get all these great people like E.G. Daly or Judith Malina just doing these like incredible scene-stealing roles. And you're just like, oh my God, why is nobody else casting them in these parts? Yeah. What are we doing, guys? Yeah.
Michael Rispoli. I mean, yeah.
Oh, Rispoli. Oh my God. Yeah, no.
One of my favorites. He was in this movie, Two Family House, which is one of my favorites.
Yes, yes. Right. Dan, I love Two Family House. Yeah.
Yes, you gotta get ready.
That's a missing movie, I think. I think that's like lost to the sands of time.
He had to upload it to Vimeo in order for people to watch it.
Reese First Cafe Society is missing as well. Talking to him.
Speaking of incredible female ensembles, not to take us down too serious of a rabbit hole, but Nancy, I have to tell you, I think your opening segment for If These Walls Could Talk is the thing that has sort of single-handedly made me pro-choice from a very young age. I kind of accidentally saw it on HBO, the Demi Moore segment. I was still in elementary school. I remember it very vividly. And I was so affected by it. Something switched in my brain where I was like, I am pro-choice kind of forever because of this piece of media that I have seen, which is such a profound impact to have on anybody. And, you know, I think that film has only become more resonant and more poignant given the current moment we find ourselves in. I rewatched it maybe 2 years ago and I was like, oh my God, this hits so much harder than it did, you know, 25 years ago when we thought these things would be protected forever. And I'm wondering about how your relationship to If These Walls Could Talk has sort of shifted in this very scary and unsustainable political moment we find ourselves in, too.
Everything you said resonates with me. For me, I mean, working on it was working with a team of people that really, really was dedicated to putting these stories out there at a time when it was not going to be popular. We didn't get any product placement support. We didn't get any corporate support for those stories. But what I really appreciate in working with all of them is that everybody had made it clear that this was going to center
the choice that an individual woman had in that situation, regardless of, you know, all the feelings that we have and all the politics. The politics is the problem, right? Because it kind of gets in there in the body. But to sort of center the woman going through it so that you could see, and the research that that I did for that first one, I you know, I interviewed nurses who who worked in hospitals in the 50s, where it was like, you know, you had to call Jane, right? Call and make those phone calls like in a chain to see, to find where it could be done and how affordable or not affordable it was for people. That affected me greatly too. And yeah, and to see the fact that it's still relevant today is kills me. You know, it kills me. I don't want it to be, you know, I didn't want it to be. And I wanted it to be something that you could look back on and say, yeah, that needed to be said at that time. But the fact that it needs to be said today is like, I don't have words.
Yeah.
Enraging, heartbreaking, like, you know, this conversation needs to just stop being a public conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a human conversation.
Yeah. But yeah, so yeah, but I'm very, very, very glad to have been a part of it. I'm very, very proud. And I remember I have family in Argentina, and I had a niece who called me like maybe a couple of years after the movie came out. And she said, you know, they showed how, If These Walls Could Talk in my class today. And Argentina at that point still did not have legislation for the right to choose. So it was a Catholic country that had abortion was illegal then. And this teacher in this high school showed the film, and my niece was like, and we had a great discussion. And I hung up the phone from that conversation. And all I could think of is like, I was so grateful to be a filmmaker, you know?
Yeah.
You can do things like that.
Can, you know, touch people.
I wonder about, like, you know, how useful are we? You know,
yeah.
But they should show it in American high schools.
Exactly.
I mean, I think a lot of people have forgotten that's not long ago, and that's where we're headed again if we do not get our business together. It's so scary.
Yeah. Women have to, but men and women, men who care about in their circle and all over, and women have to sort of understand that this violation of privacy is huge. It's huge.
Yes.
But yeah.
Yeah.
What a picture. I mean, I think that's, you know, a through line of all of your work is this just deep emotional resonance. And, you know, with Dogfight entering the Criterion Collection, with Kino doing Household Saints and True Love, I'm wondering, you know, you guys at this point in your careers, looking back, you know, what do you say to the Rich and the Nancy of the late 80s and early 90s who are just starting out, you know, knowing where this career is going to lead you and knowing how much these films now mean to people and continue being discovered by so many new folks too?
It's funny when you said that, you just put a picture in my head. Our daughter, Martina, I was pregnant with her during the filming of Household Saints. I was very pregnant with her. I was like around during that shoot. And when we found all this material, there was EPK footage of like interviews with us and Vince and Lily and Judith and Francine. And there was talk about maybe doing a DVD extra with this material. Then she was like, you know, I'd like to see this material. And I'm like, wait a minute, you're the baby that was on that set. So you should, and she's a filmmaker, my daughter. So she and Ben Sharif, her editor, put together a beautiful like 1 hour documentary using that footage from the past.
Oh, I love that.
Just now. And that's going to be a DVD extra for the Household Saints DVD. And when you said that, it just reminded me of like what Martina did with that film was she almost had us talking with each other,
over the
film, which was really interesting and very moving. And yeah, she saw stuff in that material that I could not see. Yeah. So it was very, I feel like, you know, it's great to know that these films do have something to offer this many years later. And we're really looking at parlaying the energy that we're feeling right now from it to hope to do more films, because we've, you know, we've had struggles as many filmmakers have had as films have not been, you know, seen as profitable or whatever in the years that's since, and smaller budgets have become just not something that's popular, so that only if you had a big concept or, you know, big stars do you get these stories made. So for me, it's like grateful for the past and looking forward to finding a place. So, and it's always not just for me, but really for the other filmmakers of my generation, but the young filmmakers today, so that you can do stuff at a lower budget and still tell stories that are always going to be off the beaten path and are always going to be illuminating.
Yeah. Again, it's, you know, you think that with streaming, there would be more space, but there's actually a lot less space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, not that the industry has changed that much, but it's changed. And that's the thing, you know, I know everyone says, oh my God, it's completely different. Well, it's not completely different. No. It's where it's the same is that people are not interested in making a product that will just make money.
Yep.
You have to make a product that's going to make a shit ton of money.
Bleep.
And that's fine.
Oh no, yeah.
and that's what they're interested in. And they're going to do it using the algorithm, which is going to tell them what everybody else watches or has been watching. So it's going to have to look just like that. And I think that's why a movie like Household Saints or Dogfight or True Love, why they stand out is because they're not like anything else. Or
no.
Same thing with Mississippi Masala or with
Gas, Food, and Lodging.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But those films were very different, very unique voices. Any film by Charles Burnett, you know?
Yes.
These are unique. And that is where I think, you know, that's the struggle. And it's a business, but it's not a business. It's a business in the sense that there's the desire to make a lot of money. But when you talk about low budget films now, it's like, well, you know, we're only interested in doing $10 million and up. And it's like, why? Because story that can be done at $2 or $3 or $4 million, because it's going to be a different story. You know, it's just, it's a business, but it's not really a business.
So my fantasy is that, you know, everybody's like really concerned. It's like, oh, or is AI going to take over whatever. And my answer is like, I think AI should just take over like the entire industry. And then we can do the alternate universe of powered stuff, you know, and then let audiences consume whatever they want to consume. It's okay. It's just, you know, more variety in the menu as well.
Well, I'm also very glad that you guys are educating the next generation as well. People are going to now see these films and be influenced that way. But you're both teachers, and with your organization, Missing Movies, you're kind of making sure that people are going to be able to be inspired by film and your knowledge and your passion for movies and what got you into it in the first place. And so I just want to thank you both for sharing that wisdom with us today. And it was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. So and you're part of the world that's doing the conversation, because the podcast is the same thing.
Right.
So we appreciate it too. Thank you.
Yes. I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research, equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as $1 per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more, by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the free music archive. You can also reach me or interact with Watch with Jen anytime on Twitter, either at Film Intuition or our Watch with Jen account as well. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching.
This is Jan Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.